This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And I think we're live or pre-record. Thank you very much to Hearts of Oak followers. Guests for joining us. Great to have you with us. And it's a pre-record doing a few days before. We're back onto the topic of COVID, onto medical health. And it's my great honor to have Dr. Tess Laurie with us. Thank you very much for your time, Tess.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Peter.
It's great to have you. It's you're one of the many people that have popped up over the last year that I wouldn't necessarily have come across, and obviously looking deeper and deeper into what is happening in our world, your name has popped up. So it's wonderful to have you on after watching many videos of yours. And if I could just give our viewers a little bit, you're the director of the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy Limited. That's for the last 8 years. You've got a number of letters after your name. So instead of me trying to give your background, could you just take a moment and introduce yourself to our viewers before we look into COVID treatments, new alternative to the WHO, and all of that? So, Tess, just take a moment and introduce yourself first.
Yes, well, I qualified as a medical doctor in 1990 and was very interested in obstetrics and gynecology. So most of my clinical work was spent in obstetrics and gynecology. I did a bit of postgraduate work in oncology and hematology as well. But I was intending to specialize in obstetrics, which is pregnancy and childbirth, and gynecology. And during my training, I actually lost my first child, my baby. And so, you know, we were working ridiculous hours. You know, it was sort of, you know, just we would do 36-hour shifts and so on, and I was pregnant. And so after that, I signed up to do a PhD, also in obstetrics, and that took 3 years or so. And then it just, I was focusing on wanting to have children and make a family. And so I found research a really easy way of having a family, because obviously a lot of the work could be done from home and so on. So that's sort of how I got into doing research, and in particular evidence synthesis. So evidence synthesis is sort of evaluating and preparing the evidence on any treatment or any intervention to support a clinical practice guideline. So it's sort of looking at the big picture of an intervention, and then presenting it to a panel of experts who would then decide whether there was whether the evidence was in favor of recommending the treatment, or not in favor of recommending it, or recommending it in a certain context or setting. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the UK in 2009. That was in South Africa. It was where I did my training. And I moved to the UK in 2009 and established the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy in 2013.
And what does that work with other countries? Does it work with pharmaceutical companies? Does it work with government bodies? What is the day-to-day work has been over the last 8 years there?
We do absolutely no work with pharmaceutical companies. It always was something that bothered me. They pay so much better than the work that I do, that we do at, you know, there's such a huge difference in the remuneration. But I just never felt comfortable in doing that work, because I was concerned that it might, pose a conflict of interest. And so we've only ever done work for nonprofit organizations. The bulk of our work comes from the World Health Organization, and also work done that's used for the NHS through the Cochrane collaborations. So And that's, you might have heard of, you know, the Cochrane Collaboration, the Cochrane Library. So we do a number of systematic reviews for that that database. And those reviews are used to support clinical practice guidelines around the world.
You're someone, obviously, who does a lot of work in the background. It's research, so it's much, very much behind the scenes. But you become a public figure, and I'm wondering, it was there a specific point, a specific instance, a news story, or something that happened that made you think, actually, I need to speak up on any concerns I have?
Well, I did a rapid review on ivermectin at the end of December. I saw Pierre Corey's testimony, Dr. Corey's testimony in front of the US Senate.
Yeah.
Actually, I only saw it on the 26th of December, and I think that happened on the 8th of December. So that was when the story of ivermectin kind of raised my awareness about it was raised. Mm. And I was just curious, not curious, I was surprised to see a doctor having to, beg for this safe old medicine to be used. And so I did this rapid review because I knew that many people at the WHO would be away during that time. It's a very quiet time at the WHO. And I thought, there were many people, it appeared, to be dying of COVID over that time, thousands every day, on the news. And so it seemed it was a really urgent thing to find a treatment for COVID. And so I just did what I usually do, synthesize the evidence, but I did it without support. So usually there are a few of us who work together on a review. And on that occasion, I did it on my own. I had a colleague check my data, but I did it as a rapid review. So there were some limitations in it, in that it wasn't a sort of group thing. Mm. But it was that week after I sent that report to the WHO, and I sent it to the UK authorities as well, to Matt Hancock and John Ashworth. When I had no response, I panicked. And I it was really out of my comfort zone because, as you say, I'm usually a behind-the-scenes person. Mm. And so I'm also a medical doctor, and I knew that the information I had could be saving lives that very day. January the 4th, I was thinking, there were hundreds of people dying in the UK every day. And I thought, if they could just get this information, and I felt really morally culpable in a way every day that went past. A few days later, after I'd had no response from the authorities, I thought, well, I'm just going to make a video and just, share this, and hopefully that would get a response. But I still didn't get a response. So, I've been, on a day-to-day basis, had this overwhelming pressure to share this information and to get it out there. And I've had to, in the beginning I approached it as a sprint. I was thinking, the sooner I get this out, and I was just working day and night. We established the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development Initiative. So that was what I did with that, was that I presented the evidence. We set up a meeting just like the WHO meetings are conducted. We set up a meeting like that in the UK with international doctors and scientists and civil society people as well, and some patients. And I presented the evidence just like I would usually do at a WHO meeting. Mm. And the decision at the end was that ivermectin should be recommended for the development, for the treatment and prevention of COVID. And then we established the website. It's just been just trying to get that message out has been enormously difficult because there's been such pushback. So totally unanticipated. And this is not it's not my usual job to be an advocate for a medicine. It's just halfway.
So it is quite an interesting situation from a non-medical point of view, that there has been a big push, huge money gone into vaccine production. And we did a video, and the end of next year, I think the top four companies are looking at sales of probably $500 billion, $500 billion. So obviously, the vaccine industry is big money, but if you produce something that's effective, wonderful. But there's very little emphasis on other. I mean, people are told just to stay at home and rest if you have COVID. And ivermectin is one of those that has come up. So why has that been the case? You've obviously shared your experience of that people didn't jump on this and say, this is wonderful, let's begin to use this. There has been that reticence, that pushback. What are your thoughts on that?
It has been, I agree, it's very concerning that from the beginning, the authorities seem to put this big machinery in process and action to develop new medicines without actually looking at what we have in the toolkit. Mm. And we've actually got lots of medicine, especially now we know what COVID does. Yep. We know that it causes multi-system inflammation, and we know that it causes clotting. So we know that the spike protein is kind of an allergen. It causes a reaction in us that is it's an inflammation. And so for that, you know, we need a strong immune system. So we need to be taking supplements like vitamin D, C, and zinc to boost the immune system, and many others. Okay, but also we need aspirin. We need aspirin to stop clotting. We need antihistamines. Because, you know, so there's a whole lot of medicines apart from ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and other antiviral medicines and antibiotics that work and that are necessary to help people recover well after getting COVID. Mm. And there's been an absolute silence on this, both in, and we'll just speak specifically in the UK, from the NICE, from the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, and we have sent them the evidence. We have sent them everything they need to make a recommendation on ivermectin. There's been absolute silence from the Therapeutic Task Force, and we sent a Freedom of Information request to the Therapeutic Task Force to ask how many doctors they actually had on their panel. And of 40, they're 40 people, and none of them were doctors. And they said that they outsourced that information to specialist groups. So you have these bodies, and the MHRA, the Medicines Health Regulatory Health Care Product Regulatory Agency, they are largely funded by medicines section is largely funded by pharmaceutical companies. So this, and ivermectin can be, you know, it's a generic medicine. It's very cheap. Any country can make it. The UK's government could set up a factory tomorrow and make it for everybody. And it seems like it's a pretty easy recipe to follow. So yes, there's been this focus on developing a whole lot of new drugs, which we know, you know, with new medicines, you have no long-term safety data. At best, you have acute, you know, you can say in the short term, it's okay. It looks safe in our studies, but there's no long-term safety data. And also, you know, I think it's worth remembering how drugs are usually developed. So you have animal studies, which take some months.
Yeah.
You then have phase one studies, and these involve 20 to 100 in a small group of people to look at basic sort of safety and dosage. And those take several months. Then you have phase two studies, and these can take up to 4 years, you know, where you have a slightly bigger group, say 300 people, and you're looking at safety and does the medicine work. And then you have phase three studies, which are up from 300, say 1,000 or so, a couple of thousand. And so when you take a drug And a drug doesn't make it through all those stages. So you have, you know, to get through a phase one study, only say 70% get through those. And then to get through phase two, only about 33% will get through those. So, the next phase, you've got about a 25-30% that get through. So the chance of a drug starting, from an animal study, starting from that point and making it through to market is probably it's less than 10%. So we're talking about this flurry of new medicines and injections. We've got 4 or 5 or 6 vaccines plus these other new oral therapies now. The chance of all of those actually working and being safe, you know, are so slim that it's worrying.
Well, you told us so. From looking into ivermectin, again, these are terms that none of us really had come across before COVID, but ivermectin seems to have been used and available for decades. It's not just for animals, for a horsewormer, like the media keep telling us.
Yes, and one has to wonder where they're getting that information, because it's very easy to find out that ivermectin's been used to treat worms and scabies for decades. It's very, very safe. It's especially safe in the elderly because, you know, it's used in nursing homes to prevent scabies outbreaks. And it's also used in immunocompromised people to prevent worms. So, yeah, in the UK, as far as the WHO is concerned, you can use ivermectin to treat people with COVID. If you're worried that they're going to get worms, but you can't use it to treat COVID itself, it seems. So it's used in the most vulnerable people, but also you would know if you did some really just quick research, you would find out that in 2015, its discoverers had won a Nobel Prize for medicine because ivermectin has been so of such enormous, immeasurable benefit to humanity over the last 30 years.
Mm. There was another one which, looking over to the States, because I think in the UK, only now are they talking about approving some medication for COVID treatment. I think the last 2 weeks they've talked about it. But America, looking into it, that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, they had approved remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug. Do you want to, again, why is, if something is approved for use, then why is that being ruled out in the States? And if it's been ruled in the States, why has it not been ruled out in other countries? If they have something which is approved, other drugs are emergency use authorization only, similar to the vaccine, so I guess they should be used as well. But they have drugs which have passed these tests and are approved. So why are they not being used much more widely?
Remdesivir, in actual fact, is one of those medicines that was rapidly approved and has now, in as far as the later studies go, show that it doesn't work for COVID.
Okay.
And it's potentially dangerous. It causes kidney damage in people. Wow. So the clinicians are reluctant to use it, but this is still a medicine that's in our it's in the British National Formulary, and it's allowed to be used for COVID. They say it can be used for some patients with pneumonia with COVID. Now, it's an antiviral remdesivir, so if it was to be used, it would probably be best to be used early, not amongst hospitalized patients, but it costs £3,000 or so for a course. Wow. It's not going to be, you know, your GP's not going to be prescribing it. But in any event, it's, you know, it's really, we just do not know if it actually works. So it just makes no sense to use it as a therapy for COVID. It was developed some years ago for Ebola, I think, and it wasn't found useful there either. So, yeah.
But I've, I've also looked at, they talked about repurposing. So I guess a drug which is developed for one thing, they find out that actually is effective for others. So that would mean that you could use drugs that actually are very safe and approved, and find out they have a use for something else.
Doctors repurpose medicines all the time. You know, once you know that something's good and safe, then you can give it a try. You know, in this patient, you don't know what to do, but it looks like they have something that would respond. And doctors do that all the time, and they are allowed to do that. It's they're allowed to use their judgment in that way. So what we see with ivermectin is quite extraordinary, because we have the health authorities actually writing to doctors. For example, I was sent a missive from the to GPs in Northern Ireland, where they have received a letter from the authorities to say that they are not to prescribe ivermectin. So it's really bizarre that you have health authorities overriding a doctor's judgment in terms of what would be good for their patients.
Now, if I was quite cynical, and after lots of years in politics, I might be slightly cynical, I would think that actually this is about money, because my understanding is ivermectin is a few pence for the drugs, and it is therefore not going to make anyone any money. Would that be too cynical an approach?
Not at all, Peter. I've come to the same conclusion. It seems the only logical way to understand what's going on. This huge push towards new medicines and these companies making billions, and COVID just seems to be a huge money-making industry. It's worth hundreds of billions. The drug companies have been buying shares in each other's products. I saw a news article with AstraZeneca investing in Moderna. And in fact, the other worrying thing, I see I've gone dark again, the other worrying thing is that, Google and obviously Microsoft, Gates is heavily invested in vaccines. So we've got these very powerful companies that actually own the media. Pushing for these new therapies, and they are the ones, they're profiting billions from it. So, I just hope that people can see this and really start thinking for themselves. Just applying some common sense. The salesman who's going to make hundreds of billions out of something. You really have to do your own research into that product before deciding to take it.
Well, it was a question mark I had over AstraZeneca, and I watched that vaccine and what happened to it. And it seemed to be industrial sabotage, because it seemed to be that everyone ganged up on AstraZeneca that was in the lead for vaccine production and was making a vaccine at cost price, while the others were charging $25, $30 per shot. And all suddenly all these negative reports come out against the market leader that's doing it the cheapest. And then suddenly it's withdrawn from most markets and not available as booster. Again, that's quite, if you've got something which you think works and is cheap, then rule it out. But again, it seemed as though something kind of dodgy was happening behind the scenes on that.
I'm not sure, because I have since seen, news reports from the CEO of the company saying that that as soon as COVID is declared not a pandemic, then everyone involved will be getting will be making quite a bit of money from it. So I don't think AstraZeneca is the cheap option. I think they have, I think that is an old story. But in actual fact, more to the point is that AstraZeneca, like Moderna and like Pfizer, and like all these injections, haven't been subject to the normal development of a medicine. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can develop a safe, you can be sure that you've developed a safe vaccine. And I'll go, actually, these are not normal vaccines either. So we've got a whole new technology. But there's a normal vaccine would take 7 to 10 years to develop. There's no way you can develop it in 1 year or less or 9 months. There's just absolutely no way. It can be done safely because you have, as I've explained, you have the animal studies. They take a certain amount of time. And those data need to be looked at by independent scientists before, you know, before progressing. So we've sort of, what's happened is all the studies, the phase 1, 2, and 3, seem to be rolled into one without independent evaluation at each stage. It's just been a big rush you know, and so we're at a situation now where we have rolled out a really new experimental product to a huge proportion of the world's population.
There recently, I just want to touch back on treatment. So some headlines over the last few days have been Merck says COVID antiviral pill halves risk of hospitalization. U.S. pharma group seeks authorization for first drug of its kind. That was in the FT. Another FT, AstraZeneca, seeks emergency U.S. authorization for its COVID antibody treatment. Then an ABC there in Australia. Supplies of a life-saving COVID-19 treatment have arrived in Australia. They've taken 15,000 doses of Sotrovimab. And I've seen a number of others. So let me just bring up in the Guardian. I'm sorry to have to use The Guardian, but I'll use The Guardian. In The Guardian, this story, coronavirus treatments, the potential game changers in development, and they go through and list, I'm not even going to pronounce, I'm sorry, they list a whole range. I know the Pfizer one has been talked about the last few days. There are two inhaler types, and this seems quite positive. So I don't know what your kind of view is on, this is a positive thing. What are your views on these drugs kind of becoming available?
Okay, so I see what you had there was budesonide and dexamethasone. So those are steroid anti-inflammatories. They suppress your immune system in order to help you feel better. Because what happens is with COVID is you have a viral phase. And then the next phase is an inflammatory phase where your body is just kind of almost overreacting to this toxin that's been, you know, circulating and causing, and so it's your body that causes huge inflammation. So for that stage, what's often used are immunosuppressant medicines. So that's not ideal. You want to really catch it at the antiviral stage. Okay. Again, what you're seeing there in that newspaper is a promotion of new medicines that haven't been given the time. They'll be given emergency use authorization with the exclusion of favipiral, which is an existing antiviral. But you know, the irony is just, or the double standards, the hypocrisy, because we have ivermectin, for example, which has 63 controlled studies, okay? It's got more than 100 studies of its use in COVID. Many of the studies are done in low- and middle-income countries. They're done by doctors. They're not funded by farm companies. There's no conflicts of interest whatsoever, and the doctors on the ground are saying it works. We have huge real-world data from India showing that ivermectin works and it's basically eradicated COVID in the states where it's used. But not just there, Honduras. There are many countries that wiped out COVID last year or have kept their rates really low by offering early treatment that includes ivermectin. zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, doxycycline sometimes, antihistamines. So there's a whole range of things you can do to treat COVID early. What the Guardian and other mouthpieces of the authorities are doing is they are selectively feeding the public bits of information that keep everyone in this idea that there's no effective treatment for COVID early and they're looking at these things and these things may help. That is simply not the case. There is effective treatment for COVID, and the sooner you treat it, the better. And the new drugs that they're trying to promote have only one study, for example, and that study is done by the pharmaceutical company. Those data are held by the pharmaceutical company, and it's the pharmaceutical company who's going to tell you whether it works. So the pharmaceutical company is not, you are not the customer of the pharmaceutical company. The pharmaceutical company's customers are its shareholders.
Yeah.
And so you are not the person it has to please. It's the shareholders. And so a pharmaceutical company's drugs are often, they often show really good results early on. The product gets into market, and then some years later it's shown, well, in actual fact, it doesn't really work. And I would not be surprised if this is the case with many of these new medicines. But it's not the issue of whether it works or not. My greater concern is whether it causes harm. And I fear with many of these new medicines that are being rolled out, we are seeing, we are going to see, and we are already seeing tremendous harm.
Tess, for the last, but I want to just talk about what you're doing, and people can go on to worldcouncilforhealth.org, find out some fantastic information. And you have been involved in setting this up, I guess, as a balance to the WHO or to supply the other information. Now, just touch on the WHO and then we'll discuss what you're doing there. I didn't really know much about the WHO. The WHO is now the standard by which all words and thoughts are judged regarding COVID. And they set the standard of truth, and everyone must fit in with that. And certainly YouTube have said, well, if the WHO says something, if you disagree, then you're wrong, because the WHO cannot be wrong. But it's a huge organization, $9 billion funded generally by countries. I mean, the US is its main thing. It supplies 15% of its budget. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation supply, I think, around 10%. It's generally countries, but with some organizations thrown in. Can you tell what is the WHO exactly?
Yes. So the WHO is a supposedly a non-profit organization that it has a representation of about 148 countries, I think, around the world. And it provides guidance to those countries. They're kind of, the way it seems with COVID, it seems like they're almost have to go along with what the WHO says. I never really thought about it in this way before. It always seemed like the work that I've done with it, we just provide guidance. But now with COVID, it really seems like they are the law, and you know they're the authority body, and the countries have to sort of go along with it. I think it actually has been in trouble for many, many years because the countries, it's a huge monster to run, I guess, and the countries funding it have been funding less and less. And so they have had to, you know, it's one of these examples of public-private partnerships. I think many people think the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, is a charity. It's not. One really has to look at it as industry. It's an arm of industry. It has investments, and it has an agenda. At the end of it, it's run by an individual who has huge interests in vaccines. So both financially and ideologically, I know that Mr. Gates has previously said he makes $20 to every dollar he invests in a vaccine. So vaccines have been more profitable than software, I understand. And when you consider that it's not just that, there's also the Global Vaccine Alliance, which is also his baby, so to speak, and that also contributes 7% or something to WHO's budget. So there's this huge influence from private industry on WHO. And also, obviously, countries that then pay large sums also end up having an influence. It's not an independent body. And, if you consider, for example, that Bill Gates last year was saying, well, everybody in the world has to be vaccinated, otherwise we can't end the pandemic or we can't end the lockdowns or whatever. One really needs to use one's common sense and say, should one be listening to this individual? And should this individual have a say in health policy? So in terms of where we're going, I think the system that we have, the centralized system, where we have one organization that seems to be dictating health policy to all the different countries around the world without recognition of cultural differences and individual preferences and just making these, just having this huge influence has to change. And I think the only way it can change is for people to start taking responsibility for their own health. I think we've just become so unhealthy. If you look, over the last decades, I think, we're at an all-time low in terms of mental health. We're an all-time low in terms of physical health and diseases. There's so much autoimmune disease. There's so much diabetes, heart disease, and so on. And I think it's largely because we as individuals have perhaps outsourced our care to authorities, to politicians, and so on. If they say, this kind of if they say education via Zoom is okay, then we go along with it against our better instincts, because we know that our children are suffering. It's not a great way to be educated sitting in front of a computer. Just as an example, we eat fast food. We have two family members working flat out, and so we're eating junk. We're not getting outdoors enough. We're not getting sunshine. Our quality of life is completely eroded, and I think it shows in just how people are feeling. So the World Council for Health is not a dictatorial body. It's a coalition of health focus groups from around the world, and they're all different. These groups, we're not saying there's one way to be healthy at all. What we aim to do is to draw on the wealth of information and evidence on a variety of ways of staying healthy, and we're looking at preventive health, so people can gain. We want to show people there's a better way, and it's about taking responsibility for your own health, for learning how to feed yourself, how to put healthy stuff into your body, and not just food. Information. Choose healthy information, not the stuff that makes you feel really bad and fearful, not all that negative stuff you see on the news. Turn the news off. Don't watch that. That is just propaganda. It's just help, you know, making you conform.
Because yeah, you're right. I want people to go on and make use. You've just launched this very recently, and it will provide a lot of health information that, whether it's COVID or general health, people will find helpful. And here are resources. So if you click on that, it gives all different resources on masks, on conversations about COVID in families, on pregnancy, all different help and advice. Now, I would encourage people to go in and make use of it. You launched it quite recently. What has been the response to it? And what are your plans as it grows?
Yes, the response has been really positive. I'll just tell you at the moment the structures that we have. We have 8 steering group members, and we intend to add more, and we are dispersed around the world. We hold weekly meetings where we have speakers, and we intend to live stream these in due course, because we really encourage public participation to see what doctors and scientists are discussing, the sorts of issues we're anticipating and experiencing. It's not just a medical and science group. We have legal representation as well. So we have a legal committee, and because a lot of concerns are around informed consent at the moment. So what we intend to produce and what we're working on at the moment is, as you say, COVID care, but also COVID vaccine guidance. Because, we want to help people stay healthy after vaccination as well, and also to provide them with the information they need to decide whether or not to take another shot. Because we are dynamic, we're not a bureaucratic organization that has, all these procedures and processes and funders to satisfy and so on. We are able to literally on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis adapt to the new information that's coming in. Mm. And you can see things are happening daily at the moment. Yep. We have new drugs coming in. We have new experiences like Facebook, et cetera, just shut down yesterday, Facebook. And, yep. We don't want to be an alternative to the WHO. We do not see ourselves as an alternative to the WHO. We just see ourselves as a new way forward. There's a better way to dealing with what's going on, and this is it. It's about talking. It's about openness and discussion, sharing science and experience and to determine the next steps. And it's also about getting healthier today, not necessarily just aiming for some sort of pie in the sky future. It's about what can we do today to make things better.
And just as we finish, that's the steering group up there. Your name is on the top, but one thing that impressed me was, as you mentioned, it's not just UK focused. You've got Canadian, South African, you have from all across the world, New Zealand. So it is a spread of people across the world. It's not just UK focused. So I think that, for me, that makes it also quite exciting. It's not just narrowly focused, but it is very wide. So it's certainly quite exciting to watch.
Yes, Peter, we have 50 groups now. So we have 50 affiliated groups, and it's the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, South American countries, African countries, as I say, New Zealand, Australia, America. Basically, we are drawing new groups every day because, there's so many groups at the moment. There's so many people who just feel that things don't add up. And they're looking, there are lots of different groups, and some of them are health focused, some of them are, some of them are doctor led groups, doctor scientists, and others are mixed advocacy groups, civil society, patient groups. There are patient groups now that really need representation, which it's always been the way that patient groups should obviously be involved in guidance, you know, and their voices should be heard. And that just hasn't happened. I mean, there's been no recognition from our existing authorities that people are suffering side effects from these interventions, from these new medicines and vaccines. You know, previously healthy people are feeling unwell after getting these vaccines. And there's been no recognition. It's like we're not allowed to talk about it. You know, we are representing those groups, and we encourage anybody who is part of a group to look at what we're offering, and to contact us and think about joining our organization.
Okay. Tess, thank you so much for your time. You've obviously got a lot on, and thank you so much for your time coming on. And I would really encourage our viewers to go and make use of that. Go sign up to worldcouncilforhealth.org. The link is in the description. It's on the screen there. I think all of us are trying to make sense, and we put out regular videos of individuals talking. But if you want to go deeper, then sign up and get the information there. Use the resources, they're available for you to make sense of it, and so you can live healthily. So thank you, Tess, for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, thank you. And let me just finish off with our viewers. Thank you for watching. This is on all the platforms, not just on the live stream. It'll also be up on the pre-recorded platforms, and it's also on all the audio. So if you're listening on Podbean, if you're listening on any of the other audio on Spotify, then I hope you have enjoyed it. And do make sure you sign up to our weekly email. Go to heartsofoak.org, click on that Connect tab, put in your name and email, and you'll get our weekly email. Any input you want, any thoughts, any recommendations, any criticism, send them to info@heartsofoak.org, and we will get back to you as soon as possible. So I think on that, thank you to Tess, and thank you to our viewers or listeners. And I wish you a wonderful rest of your day, and look forward to seeing you on our next interview. So thank you so much, and goodbye.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.